and welcome to the Eastern Front. My name is Yulia Zsozsa. I'm with the Middle East Institute, Georgetown, and George Washington University, and I'm joined by my colleagues.
Giselle Donnelly, I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and
Dalip Burohash, also with AEI.
On our podcast, we talk about the many challenges to European peace that tend to emerge along a line running from the Baltic to the Black Sea, the Eastern Front, and about why those matter to the United States. If you enjoy this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. Today, we have with us Nicolas Karim, who is the editor-in-chief and vice president of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. She is joining us from Prague to talk about the many challenges of reporting for RFERL in a very hostile environment, such as in Russia and Iran, and about coverage of the war in Ukraine. Previously, she served for 2 decades as a journalist covering 6 wars, including the first 6 months of the full-scale invasion for CNN, as well as for BBC and other outlets. Nicolas, it's great to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, frontline reporting, been with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty now for less than a year, but already been to Ukraine. And we know that covering Russia while with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty is considered increasingly difficult, and Russia is cracking down on what it considers a foreign agent. So are things getting more dangerous on the Eastern Front? How would you describe the situation, particularly as we're looking into Russia and Ukraine?
Look, the fundamental risks involved in being a journalist have, from where I'm sitting, grown significantly over recent years for everyone involved in international journalism. And the position we find ourselves in today is one where the levels of threat, the type of threats that we're facing, are far more complex. You know, we are not only thinking about the physical safety of our journalists. They literally risk life and limb to report from the front lines, but our journalists are also on the front lines in the fight for media freedom right now. You know, bullets and bombs are only part of the danger we face. We're dealing with a very rapid descent away from democratic values across vast swathes of the world, but most profoundly across the geographies that RFERL operates in: Iran, Russia, the Caucasus, and parts of Eastern Europe. On top of that, we're seeing regimes feeling emboldened, in my view, by a sort of diminished rules-based international order, where international diplomacy might once have deterred autocratic regimes from crossing a line. We're seeing a kind of normalization of repression. Take Hungary as an example. Despite the eroding of democratic values under Viktor Orban, Hungary has not been isolated from the international community. It remains a member of NATO and the European Union. And while it's not my job as a journalist to decide how democracies respond diplomatically to these things, if a repressive regime see there are no consequences to shunning democratic values, they'll continue to do what suits their interests. And that has a profound impact on the ability of journalists to be able to do their jobs without fear of persecution, imprisonment, or worse. So in answer to your question, yes, the risks involved in carrying out our jobs, particularly in the regions we work in, are becoming profoundly more difficult.
If I may go back to the question of frontline reporting for a bit. Well, I was struck recently watching 20 Days in Mariupol, the Oscar-winning documentary that looks at the early phase of the war in Mariupol, and film that provides a lot of raw footage of, you know, some of the most horrific things that you can possibly imagine. And we very often in the West sort of take it for granted that footage from front lines just reaches us and that there would be somebody filming things. But the documentary sort of reminded me that it's not obvious at all. And there were, you know, different reactions to the crew filming inside hospitals and so on. Some people were sort of mildly irritated, but there were lots of Ukrainians who were encouraging the filming crew to document what was happening and getting the message out there. I'm not sure if this is even a question, but it takes a particular personality, I suppose, to be able to, you know, do this job over an extended period of time. I wonder if you have sort of any observations on how hard it is for a person to sort of, you know, be a lifetime war journalist, war correspondent, being exposed to these scenes anew and be being able to remain focused on doing their job, even if that means, you know, being a bystander in truly horrific situations.
Yeah, I mean, the challenges are great and the impact on individuals is profound. And I've been doing this kind of work for many, many years now, and working alongside the bravest of journalists. And generally, you know, when other people are running towards safety, we are running towards the danger. And I've seen brave journalists do this over and over and over again. And there's this real desire in conflict journalists to be there on the ground, to bear witness. You know, they understand the importance of the very worst things that happen in conflict not happening in the dark. And I think it's that motivation which is to ensure that the world is able to witness what happens on the ground during conflict and the very severe effects that conflict has on the civilian population largely. That desire to get that news out to the world just takes over. And, you know, thoughts and fears about your own personal safety can often take a back seat, which is why it's really important for organisations like ours to have processes in place to protect people. Because quite frankly, frontline journalists aren't always the best people to assess whether they should be running towards danger. Sometimes it takes someone else to be looking out for them and make sure that they have everything that they need to stay safe because of this fundamental instinct to move towards the danger so that they can bear witness.
Nicola, I wonder if we could talk a bit about what, you know, fashionable elites now call reporting from the gray zone of conflict, which is something less than all-out hostilities, but obviously something more threatening and more dangerous than a peaceful democratic environment. And in that regard, and we have focused here from time to time on detained journalists in Russia, but I'm wondering what the situation is, say, in Hungary, or is becoming maybe in Slovakia and other countries that are sort of in the middle of larger European conflict, what the dangers are for your people there, and whether there's an even different approach that you as their editor sort of need to employ in that sort of a situation.
It's a great question, because the risks are not always as obvious, and how you therefore mitigate those risks, it can be more challenging. So, you know, you will find in some regions that we work that there is a constant intimidation, which doesn't go quite as far as stopping us operating on the ground or preventing us from accessing the country. But it may be in terms of making it difficult for us to get accreditation on the ground. It might come in the form of not giving us access to politicians or the voices that we need to do our jobs properly. And the one thing that remains constant is the fact that we will not bow down to that kind of pressure. We will not allow that kind of pressure to affect the kind of journalism we do or interfere with our editorial decision making. It's a fine balance, of course, because you're constantly weighing up your ability to operate on the ground with the future risks of accreditation being taken away or journalists being asked to leave the country. But essentially, my view is that if it gets so bad in a country that you can't operate freely, then perhaps it's better to be operating from outside the bounds of that country anyway.
If I could just quickly follow. So, you know, if you're going to the front lines or embedded with a combat unit, you can give your people, you know, a Kevlar helmet and vest and so on and so forth. You know, there's almost a well-established checklist of things that you can do to make sure that your people stay safe. Have you developed, or is there a similar sort of standard set of procedures or steps that you can take if, you know, again, just to use as an example, somebody's being assigned to Hungary, for example?
Yeah, we have to assume that we are being listened to when we correspond with each other on the ground. We have to assume that governments might have access to our communications and our correspondence. So there are ways that we attempt to protect ourselves from that unknown risk. And technology allows us to use platforms like Signal, for example, to communicate with each other to avoid that kind of situation. But you're absolutely right to point out that, you know, there aren't such established risk mitigations for these grey zones. And that's a really good point, because the risk isn't always as obvious. And so I guess we're still in a situation where we're dealing with things as and when they come up, as opposed to having such a tight mechanism for dealing with risk in those grey zones.
I wonder if you wouldn't mind sharing sort of specific examples from a country like Hungary, where RFERL returned after, you know, some time away from being in the country, of intimidation, harassment, the sort of things that your journalists encounter. Because clearly this is a country that hasn't really progressed down the path of authoritarianism as much as Russia or Turkey, but nonetheless there are all kinds of, I suppose, you know, administrative hurdles, petty sort of indignities that the sort of government can deploy against people and journalists they don't like.
Yes, the main challenges we face are in terms of access. They're in terms of access to members of the government so that we can interview them and hold them to account in the way that we would do when reporting other democratic countries, and in terms of being granted accreditation for our journalists on the ground. I don't have specific examples for you from Hungary over the last few months, I'm afraid. I can certainly get those to you from our service director from Hungary, but it's certainly not to the degree that we're facing in Russia and Iran, for example, where it's far more repressive.
Can you talk exactly about that? You're sort of preempting my question about Iran too. We're increasing the curious on the Eastern Front, literally and figuratively, about Iran, but particularly I think many of our listeners are interested in Russia, and RFERL is one of the few that remains, but under very hostile circumstances. And I'm wondering also how these challenges are changing in terms of the crackdown, particularly in the current context. We've had a lot of attempts of media coverage in the context of Navalny's death and now the so-called election with record high votes of Putin. And so I'm wondering if you can give us a description of how the crackdown is increasing, of the challenges that are increasing in terms of coverage as we're looking into particularly Russia, but of course Iran too.
Of course. Look, one of the greatest threats to RFERL is the rapid proliferation of new legal frameworks to censor free expression. And across our region, we're seeing the emergence of foreign agent laws and so-called disinformation bills designed to criminalize what we do. We are quite literally under attack because with the diminished role of international diplomacy and the erosion of rules-based international order, which I mentioned, we journalists pose the greatest threat to those who wish to crush democracy, like Vladimir Putin and his regime. The free press is, quite frankly, I would say, under assault in a way we've never seen before. And in Russia, where many of these legal frameworks originated, authorities have forced RFERL to suspend in-country operations. They did that 2 years back because we refused to comply with the so-called foreign agent law. And just last month, they've labelled us as an undesirable organisation. And that means that even sharing our content inside Russia could land you with up to 4 years in jail. It really is the most serious assault on press freedom that the world cannot afford to ignore. The very nature of why we exist means that the job of RFERL journalists is always going to be far more challenging than those reporting in and on countries where democratic values are respected. For governments in Russia and Iran, who are very actively seeking to control access to information, we present a huge threat, an existential threat even, because we fill the gap that is left in local media and civil society where they attempt to suppress and censor. So I guess they see us actively working against them as the enemy. We are not able to operate freely on the ground in Russia and Iran. So the reality is that we cannot always do traditional journalism. You know, we may not be able to simply take a camera to a town square and film a protest. We couldn't actively film people laying flowers for Navalny in Moscow. We have to think about the risks not only to our journalists, but also now to contributors who have been criminalised, to members of the public interacting with us. But it means that we have to find ways and means to stay connected, to ensure that we're able to continue to information gather. And every day, governments like Russia and Iran are finding new ways to censor our reporting. They block our websites. But as they become more and more repressive, the need to serve our audiences becomes stronger. Our resolve becomes stronger. So we've developed multiple mechanisms to circumvent censorship, and we continue to speak to our audiences about how to use tools like VPNs, for example. Our mobile apps come with censorship circumvention tools built into them, and we use mirror links to ensure that people can access our content even when our sites are blocked. So where advancements in technology sometimes work against us, they also mean that we can do journalism even when we're not on the ground or we can't operate openly.
I have what may seem like a bit of an off-the-wall question, but how do you cover, I mean, the current environment is increasingly populated by people whom I think generously described as Western authoritarian stooges. So when Tucker Carlson goes to Moscow, it's a newsworthy event, but it's propaganda from start to finish. Or take, for example, my personal bete noir, Rod Dreher in Budapest. From your perspective, are they worth covering? Is it possible to sort of translate what they really mean versus what they say for the audience that you serve? Or is this just too minuscule a subject?
Again, a great question. And look, in my view, we can't ignore these things because, you know, we know that there is a significant percentage of the population, especially young audiences, who are listening to Tucker Carlson on TikTok and on Instagram. And you cannot let that go unchallenged, in my view. The importance is to think about the prominence that you're giving something like that versus the public interest in challenging it. And that can be a fine balance. You know, you don't want to go too far the other way, where you're introducing Tucker Carlson to new audiences, quite frankly, but also you want to make sure that, you know, his view of the world and what he's propagating and pumping out there is challenged in a factual way, which includes context and analysis for people who might otherwise not understand the fact that this is blatant propaganda.
I wonder if we can go back a little bit to something we touched upon at the beginning, and that is war coverage in the context of Ukraine. Dalibor was inching towards that with an earlier question, but I wonder if we can tap into your experience having covered now 6 wars over the last 2 decades. And the assessment is the following, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. In the first year, to me, we have seen unprecedented public support for Ukraine with mass demonstrations due to the fact that we had brave journalists on the ground and that media and access to technology has been like never seen before. And to me, that's been very different from Syria, where we've had carpet bombing attempts from Russia, successful in this instance, also due to the fact that we haven't had much coverage through the many years prior to the Russian intervention in Syria and after that. Indifferent of the atrocities, we've had coverage, but it's been a lot more limited. And of course, we haven't had documentaries winning Oscars. And you've been to Ukraine now in the second year, close to 2 years of the full scale invasion. We also know that coverage of Ukraine has for a while now disappeared from the front pages of Western media. So how do you make sense of that, comparing initial support for Ukraine to what we've had in previous somewhat recent wars? And also, how should we be processing and I guess fighting against the fact that Ukraine is, no matter how much they're being bombed as we speak, seems to be disappearing from the front pages?
Well, Well, look, I worked on covering the terrible conflict in Syria as well as the conflict in Ukraine. And, you know, I can tell you from experience, it certainly wasn't as easy to get the space in rundowns or on news websites for the story in Syria. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that the closer people in international newsrooms feel to the story, the closer their audiences feel to the story, the more prominence they give it. And quite frankly, this conflict between Russia and Ukraine feels a lot closer to very many people, not just people in Europe, but also people in North America. And so I think that the question of how the audiences of international news organizations can be affected and impacted by a conflict directly correlates with the prominence that news organizations give that conflict. As for the diminishing kind of prominence of the Russia-Ukraine war, this is something that we all have to think about very seriously. I mean, if you look on RFERL's website today, the massive assaults on Ukraine's power infrastructure is right up at the top of our page. But if you look at BBC News, if you look at the Washington Post and the New York Times, you won't see the same thing. And that's a problem because, you know, the longer a conflict goes on, the less progress that is made, the more fatigue sets in, not just with the audiences, but with those who are making the editorial decisions on which stories to cover and how. And so as journalists, it becomes harder and harder, quite frankly, as wars continue to keep them prominent. And so we have to find ways to break through the fatigue that develops as conflicts go on, to break through the apathy which sets in audiences, not just audiences, but governments and politicians as well. And we need to do all we can to keep Ukraine in the headlines, and we are finding that more and more difficult. The good news is that our audiences particularly are showing us in their behaviour that they're still incredibly interested in daily information on what's happening inside Ukraine. And if other editors from other newsrooms are listening, I would kind of ask them to take note of the fact that our audiences are telling us in very large number that they're still incredibly interested in keeping updated on what's happening in Ukraine.
I just wonder if you could say a word about the stress on your reporters and correspondents, whether there's kind of a traumatic stress element that you as an editor need to manage.
100%. Look, being a journalist now is harder than it has ever been before, for very many reasons. And that's not just journalists who are working on front lines. I do believe that there is a mental health crisis in the industry right now, and there are a number of pressures bearing down on journalists, be it news avoidance, be it digital transformation, be it a real squeeze on budgets and finances. There's job losses all over the place. And in general, it's not a very secure industry to be in. So that has very many mental health implications as it is. And on top of all of that, our journalists are putting themselves in the line of fire on a daily basis. And that has a profound effect on mental health. On top of that, our journalists are covering conflict in their own countries. You know, can you imagine? They are witnessing their own people dying in front of their eyes. And that with it brings an increased level of stress and trauma. So we're always thinking about ways that we can address that. And I think, you know, the risk to mental health needs to be taken as seriously as the risk to physical health. It is a very real problem, which most journalists who cover frontline or conflict reporting, who see a degree of suffering that we will never see in our lives, hopefully, there is a cost which comes with that. and you cannot avoid it. And the moment as a human being you stop feeling is probably the moment you have to stop doing this job.
From that, I hear all the more reason for our audiences and beyond to check the RFERL website instead of the New York Times.
I think that's absolutely right.
Thank you, Nicola Karim, Vice President and Editor-in-Chief of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, for joining us today. From me, Julia Zsozsa, and my friend.
Me, Giselle Donnelly, and
Dalibor Hajc.
Thank you for listening to the Eastern Front. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. To stay up to date with the Eastern Front, please give us a follow on Twitter or X at Eastern Front Pod, one word, and sign up for the newsletter included in our show notes. You can find more episodes and additional content on our website, aei.org, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you, and until next time, goodbye.